This is John Golly Galsworthy, recorded by Chris Alden Lee on the 17th of June, 2011. John Galsworthy, Part 1.
John Galsworthy, live in Halstead Cane, Sussex, and I was born 21st January 1940.
So you're now?
I'm now at the glorious age of 71.
And were you born in Sussex?
Born in the same house I live in now.
Even now, 71
Even now.
Years later?
Yes, yes. Never moved, apart from family.
So you've been to the Antarctic but never moved house.
That's right, that's right.
And what was your turn of duty down south? Where were you and when were you there?
I went down 66 to 76 as a builder. So I went all the bases, I built on all the bases, various ones. Built three Halley Bays and they've all fallen down.
But it's not your fault?
Not my fault, definitely not my fault.
What was your education like, John?
County secondary school at Haywards Heath, B stream, good at woodwork, and I guess I went from there to got a job as a carpenter with one of the local firms, and then went to Lewis Technical College, got a pass in carpentry and joinery,
yeah,
and general building, and got to sit in guilds in that, and then did my apprenticeship. And then I guess a travelling bit started. I must have been a pain to my mother because I must have been talking about travelling, and she saw an advert in the paper for the Falkland Islands for a carpenter. So I applied for it and then looked in the map to see where I was going and got the job in Falklands, which was a 3-year contract, and I did 3.5 years there.
Before we get to that, tell me a bit about your parents. Were they professional class people? Or?
My mother was Scottish, came down to England as a domestic servant, I guess, you know, like many people did in those days. And my grandparents owned a shop, and my dad worked there for a bit, and then he got a job in the civil service in the passport office. And so they were, my mum never worked, I don't think, but she was pretty damn bright with my mum, good woman.
So there was no history of secondary education or further education, as we would now call it?
Not that I know of, no. Not for, with me, you mean?
Well, in the family, I mean. In
not
your,
that I know
family.
Of, no, no.
And what was it about carpentry that attracted you?
I don't know, I just was quite good at it. I think at school, we did it at school, and I was quite good at it. And I was job hunting, funnily enough, and I was on the bus, and one of the chaps that in the village said, got a job yet, John? I said, no, I'm still looking. And he said, well, Munyon's a local firm, take on carpenter apprentices. So I went there and got my dad to look them up and ended up as a carpenter with them. And it was a really, really good firm, top quality firm. So we did really good work.
Furniture?
No, it was all building, building. But we had a really good joiner shop with a top quality joiner that taught me a lot. And even through my life, I used to do things, and I think, oh, that's not quite right. And I let it go, and I thought, no, Len wouldn't let that go out of the workshop, so I'd alter it. So you had a really good training and fussy, and I'm still quite fussy on doing things.
Sounds like quite an Edwardian approach to
it. It was in those days. The old man, as we used to call him, was probably the last of the pre-war gentleman type bosses, I guess, you know. We always used to sort of bow and scrape to Mr. Munyon, and, you know, you're definitely the last of the of that era of the, what would they mean, before the war era of people anyway.
So was it from there that you actually went to the Falklands?
From
Munyon's?
Yes, yes. Yeah, I finished my apprenticeship and had about a year at home, and then got the job in the Falklands, and off I went.
And the attraction of the Falklands was simply that it was
abroad. It was somewhere. They didn't know where.
Did your mother know where it was when she got the advert?
I don't know. Because a lot of people, the Mickey out on me, cycling friends of mine, because I'm saying, oh, I'm not sure about that. Because I'm going abroad. Where are you going? The Falklands. You know, Scotland. I said, no. I said, you can't get much further away. That's only the Falklands. I said, no, it's Scotland, rather. No, it's south. You know. And an interesting bit, actually, I found was, when I went for the interview, there was another chap there, and I thought, oh, somebody after my job. And we got chatting. This was in Crown Agents in London. And I got chatting to this chap, and he was a mechanic. And I thought, oh, that's all right. And I said, where are you going then? And he said, the Antarctic. I had no idea. And I thought the Falklands was the end of the world, and this chap was going somewhere else. So that was fine, you know, the job was fine. And then later, when we had the job, I was talking to Dad Etchells, who's well known, and we were chatting away, and we're not 100% sure, but we're nearly 99% sure that we were the two people that met in Crown Agents at that time.
Yeah. What year would that have been?
66. Yeah, 66. We went in 62. No, wait a minute. I went to the Falklands. Yeah, 62. 62. I went to the Falklands in 62.
Right. Halley was 67.
Yes, that's it, yes.
And you did 3 years.
Yeah, well, I ended up doing 3.5 years in the Falklands.
Paint me a little thumbnail sketch of the Falklands and Port Stanley in particular in the early 60s.
Well, everybody had to go down on the Darwin from Montevideo, and it rolled. It was flat-bottomed, and it was awful. And the cabins were had long curtains in them from the top to the bottom of the bunk, so if you were feeling seasick, these six-foot-long curtains would swing out and back, and it was like a pendulum, you know. So everybody, the governor had to suffer out the Darwin. It was very much a working place, in that you had the shepherds, the peat cutters. People worked. So if you were good at what you did, you were really admired for it. Now, he's a good peat cutter. He's a good shearer. He's a good shepherd. He's a good plumber. You know, obviously there was administration people. But it was very much a working place and very, if I say backward, it wasn't backward at all, but the telephone system was on number 8 fencing wire, and it was all done with rings on the telephone, so, you know, your phone number might be 3 shorts and a long, and people knew what it was without listening. But you could listen to everybody else's phone call as well, and some of the outside shepherds' houses, because shepherds used to live out on their own in the fields, in the camp, and they had to speakers on permanently into the telephone line, so you could just hear all the conversations going on. And also in town, if you were ringing somebody, you'd ring the exchange and say, I want so-and-so. No, they're not in at the moment. Oh, any idea where they are? And they say, yeah, she's, well, they might be at so-and-so. Can you try there for me? And they'd ring round the houses for you to know where the people were. But it was really good, and I loved it there. You know, it was such a basic life, and the social life was good. People said, what did he do? But the social life was really good, because I was keen on dancing. So, you know, I used to go to the dances, and through the dances you got to meet people and you were socialising with people, and then I played badminton and, you know, just got to know people, and it was really, really good. Always busy, and through my life I've been to other places. When I went to New Zealand, or sometimes the backwoods of Canada, not exactly the backwoods, but I can appreciate the lifestyle of people that are living a simple life, I guess you'd call it, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, there's any semblance of culture, or theatre, or cinema?
We had a cinema once a week, Hardy's Cinema, and whether you'd seen the film 4 times, you always had to go to the cinema. And that was a nightmare when you first went there, because in the town hall, it was held in the town hall, and you walked in facing the audience. The films only started when at a certain time. So you'd walk in facing the audience, and when you were new there, because everybody's looking and saying, who's this coming, who's this coming? You know, and they'd all look at you. But once you'd been there for a while, the next thing was having a girlfriend. You know, and it was known among your friends that you were, and I think for the girls it was, if you had seen going to the cinema with somebody, it was more or less that you were going together.
An item.
That was an item. You were advertising it. You know, and then, of course, you'd walk in and everybody, oh, you know, half knew and half didn't. Oh, he's made it tonight. You know, he's going with him, you know. And then you'd sit there, and once you'd been there a few years, well, a good while, you got to know the thing, and then other people would come in, because you'd do exactly the same. Is he going to buy them sweets? Because it was a little sweet counter, you know, so you come in and, are they going to buy sweets? Oh, yes, buying your sweets. You know, it was awful, really, till you got used to it, you know.
Did you find yourself in that position yourself?
Oh, yeah. I went out with one of the girls there for quite a long time, quite seriously, you know, and so, you know, you become part of the place as well, and... Yeah, so yeah, we all go through it. And even walking up in the town when you were first there, you know, people would look out. And
I remember Lofty Tyson told me that cinema story when he took a girl to the cinema. Does that name ring a bell?
Oh, Lofty Tyson, yeah, I met him. Yeah, I met him there.
He's probably slightly older than you.
Yes, yeah, I met him, because I met quite a lot going through the Falklands. Mm.
He also felt the beady-eyed scrutiny of walking up past the screen with a girl in his arms.
Oh, yeah, oh, there, I see, that was true then, wasn't it? And you couldn't do anything without being found out. You know, that's the other thing, you know. Go from the wrong end of town. You know, you go... I lived, if you come out of the cinema, I'd sort of turned left-handed, basically. And I went out with a girl that had to go right-handed into her place. And people would say, where were you coming from then? Yeah. Oh, yes, you know, that's why he's coming that way. And you could get, you know, you couldn't get away with anything. It was great.
Was that okay, or was that... was there something within you which... actually resented a bit of that as well?
No, not a bit.
No?
Not a bit. No, I loved it. I've always lived in the country. I'm a country person, I guess, living in the village as a youngster. You know, people knew where you were. Mm. Your parents knew where you were. No, it wasn't a problem at all. Quite fun, in fact, I think.
And what about the other social aspects of Port Stanley? There were, I think, four pubs?
Yes. Well, it was a great drinking place. And I didn't drink at all before I went there, not a bit. But it was really, might sound weak-willed saying this, but it was actually quite difficult not to drink. Because you'd go to somebody's house and they'd say, oh, then, Che, do you want a drink? Oh, I'll have a cup of tea. No, I meant a drink. And, you know, gradually you get into it and got to drink gin. And, you know, became a gin drinker. And with tonic, which made me ill. So somebody said, try lemonade. So I drink gin and lemonade and never look back since. You know.
And all that drink, in fact, all the suppliers, well, no, that's not strictly true. All the drinks certainly would have to have been imported, wouldn't it?
Mm. Yeah, they all came down on the... there was a ship, the AES, that was Danish or something like that. I think that came in 3 or 4 times a year. And that came with bulk supplies, so it, all the booze and that would come in, but I guess Darwin would bring in a lot of it as well, but it was all brought in bulk supplies. And in fact, when we were with Bass, the Rose Hotel, there's Velma Malcolm and George, they ran the Rose Hotel, and in fact they really looked after Fitz well, and all of their booze went through the Rose Hotel. You know, they must have done quite well out of it, supplying us down south for years and years. Yeah, really good. I mean, everything came in by sea, and you'd want something. You think, oh, the ship would be coming in next month. So you'd wait for it. But it was the same if you wanted films. We used to take a lot of photos.
Mm.
And it was like a 3-month round trip because the ship was only once a month. So you'd send your films off to Kodak, which took a month there, a month in England and a month back. So everything took 3 months if it was a round-trip sort of item that you were looking for.
What about electricity? Was there any...
Oh, yeah.
Was there any general distribution, any national grid, or was it all done locally?
Well, it was locally to Stanley. So you got Port Stanley with its generators that did that. And but the farms all had their own generators because they were miles away anyway.
So there was a power station of
sorts? No, a proper good power station with good, reliable electricity. Oh, no, it was very not backward in that way. And, in fact, the Falkland Islands are quite switched on people to what's going on. And I guess these days they'll all be into computers and emails, and they're right up with it, and they always have been, and you know they always have been on them.
Well, in some respects electronic communications probably revolutionised the Falklands more than it has the UK or Argentina, hasn't it?
I would imagine yeah. Well,
their need was great.
Well, it certainly did on the bases.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're in Bristol, and we're going to have dinner tomorrow night on the SS Great Britain. Mm-hmm. But I imagine you might have seen it in the Falklands when it was a wreck.
Yeah, we did. We because it was in Sparrow Cove, which was sort of outside of the inner harbour, it was a little bit difficult to get to. So we went out there once or twice, had a little boat, and we went out there and used to go muscling on it, getting muscles off it, and just try and get out there and climb around on it. But I don't really know that much about it. It was there, and we got out a couple of times. But really, in all truth, that's all I know about it.
Was there plenty of work in Stanley for a carpenter, or did he have to diversify?
No. For working for government, we were really busy. We were kept going all the time. There were John Collins, me, a handyman, and then another chap. So there were three carpenters and a handyman with the government. And we were busy all the time. And in actual fact, privately, we used to do work as well. You know, people often wanted jobs doing privately, although we didn't do a lot. You could have done a lot more if you wanted, but there was always work. There was always work. And I think there was always work for people that were good at what they did.
Mm.
You know, so, no, it was fine from that point of view.
Were you ever homesick for the UK?
No, never. Never. Never.
So how did that period of your life, those 3 years, 3.5 years in the Falklands, how did that come to a close?
The end of the contract. I mean, it was a 3-year contract, and I did another 6 months. And then that was the end of the contract. And while I was in the Falklands, because I got to know all the Bass people, because the ships are coming in, and they used to come into Stanley at the time. So I got to know the people on the ships. And really, I never even went for an interview. So I left the Falklands knowing I'd got this job to go back south again.
So you came back to the UK?
I came back to the UK. And then that was in... Well, I must have left England in September on the Biscoe, which was...
September 7,
66.
66. Just after the World Cup.
Yeah, was it? I don't know. Don't follow football.
So you came back to England, but by that time... Sorry, by the time you headed back to England from the Falklands, you'd already secured yourself...
Yes.
The following year's work in...
Yes.
The Antarctic.
In the Antarctic, yes.
And what was the attraction? Because 3 years previous, you didn't know where it was.
No. I guess just talking to the people, and the people were there, and you got to know about the place more, which was interesting. But as an aside to that, interestingly, a friend of mine, one of his girlfriends that's now married and lives in England, I mean, we still keep in contact with her and her husband and family. We were chatting not that long ago about the Falkland Islanders and the Antarctic. And I said to, and I was the same. I said, you know, I don't really think when we lived there, we knew what was going on in the Antarctic. You know, the ships came in, all these lads went south, they came back with beards and long hair, and we danced and partied, and away they went. And I don't really think people knew. And I said to this girl about it, and she said, I think you're right. You know, it was, they just went south, and nobody really knew what they did. And then another one in hindsight that I regret was that Dr. Slessor was there, that was one of the early people. He was a doctor in Stanley, and a chap, Davy Jones, who was air mechanic at Stonington. And I mean, I worked with, not so much with a doctor, but I worked with Davy Jones up at the hangar once. We did a job up there. And I never thought to talk to him about the Antarctic or Slessor. And they were almost historic people because they were, you know, before it, FIDS really got going, or, you know, it was the early days of FIDS, you know, because they were just there. I find that quite interesting that we, you know, I say it was only last year or a couple of years ago that I spoke to this girl and we were chatting about it.
So what sorts of things were the FIDS, returning FIDS, saying that made you feel as though the Antarctic was worth exploring personally? What was attracting you?
I think it was somewhere different to go. And because it was there, I mean, we were in the Falklands and we were there, and it was another step, I guess, you know, to go south. It was like another step. It wasn't like going somewhere completely different, like Africa or somewhere. I can't really answer that truthfully to know.
Wasn't the dogs or the scenery or the...
No, it was just... It was there and there was jobs to do and it sounded a good idea, and that, you know, away I went.
You'd not seen Scott of the Antarctic or read about Shackleton?
There was nothing really that drew me there from a historic or... I guess you get interested in the place talking to people enough, but not... It wasn't a great passion to go, if that's the right word. Sounds a bit bad saying that.
No, not at all. So you bypassed the Bill Sloman interview, the sound
I certainly did, yeah.
And they took you on as a carpenter?
Yeah, carpenter builder. Mm.
And when you... At what point did you know which part of the Antarctic you were being sent to?
When I came back to England. When I came back and I went to the office. And, I mean, obviously I had to sign a contract and that to do it, but I didn't have an interview to do it. And I knew I was going back to the Halley Bay because there was a big building programme on that year. So yeah, I became part of that building programme. And, I mean, another funny one, it's like Fanny Hill. I don't know if he's put his name.
David.
David Hill, Fanny. We all had nicknames. And we got to Cambridge for the induction course, and this chap came up to me and said, "You on this bloody bass lark?" And I said, "Yes, yeah, I am." Do you know, and we've been pals ever since. We're still pals to this day, which is fantastic. And I think that's what...
Cool.
I think that's one of the things with the Antarctic, is some of the friends that I've met, I'm still really friendly with.
Tell me about going to Southampton for your embarkation.
Well, that was interesting. My mother came down with me. My dad really wasn't that well. And we went to Southampton and arrived at the docks. And because Southampton docks were going somewhat better than they are now. And what was amazing, as we went in, the QE2 was in dock on one side over the sheds. And you could see this enormous ship up and above you. And when we came to the Biscoe, you actually had to step from the deck down onto it. So you've got this... Here we are going to the end of the world on this tiny little ship with about... I think there was only about 4 feet of freeboard from the well deck to the water. It was a great ship, you know, it's really good. But that was... And all the in those days, all the office staff used to come down and see you off. So there was Sir Vivian Fuchs and a lot of the office people, the girls, they used to give the girls in the office a day out. So coming from London then at Gillingham Street, the office there, so they would all come out for the day. And they'd all, you know, we'd all see them on the ship and you'd get waved off by Sir Vivian, which was...
How'd you got to know him at all?
Oh, yes, over the years, yes. And the... Gillingham Street was really quite small, so you could nearly wander in and wander around and chat. And there weren't that many people there in those days. And they were all people that are probably, not all of them, but some of them I probably met while I was in the Falklands. So it was somewhere I could go in and see people and chat away. And it was very small and relaxed. And that was it. You know.
What did you make of Sir Vivian? Or Vivian, as he was at that point.
Yeah. I mean, he was a really nice chap, actually, and I genuinely mean that. You know, he was easy to get on with, and, you know, you didn't feel in awe of him as such. You know, he was... Because it was really small days, and everybody was just there. You know, they were just part of the FIDs, part of FIDs in those days. So you really just chatted away to people. And I think he was probably like a lot of people that are of his ilk. They're sort of driven. They have a passion and... They're driven, and you get the feeling that he was not driven in a bad way, but, you know, he had a purpose, and that was it. That came through as a strong, strong leader, but a good one, yeah. Probably could be a pain in the whatnots at times, I would think, because of his passion. And I think he was... I mean, I never was on base with him, but apparently, you know, he always had to be the first one up and the first one to have his porridge and... That sort of thing, you know. I mean, I guess that was where people like that have that drive, I guess, the word, isn't it?
Would you have known who you were?
As time went on, yes. Oh, yeah, because of the years I spent in the Antarctic and having my nickname as Golly, and everybody knows me as Golly. So, yeah, oh, yes, yeah, he'd know me, yes, yeah. Oh, yeah, he'd chat to me, and yeah, I'm fine, yes.
Once you climbed down to the Biscoe, what was she like in those days? This was the old wooden.
No, not the wooden Biscoe. This was the metal one. No, it was comfortable on board. We had, I can't remember how many to a cabin, but a little fiddery on there, and and it was, no, it was good. It was comfortable. Yeah, it was good. Yeah, and very friendly, of course. And the crew were good. I mean, I think some of the people you meet, I was trying to think of the old FIDs that were on board, and I can't think who were the old FIDs on board when we went south at Teach You What's Going On. Mm. I really can't remember that. But the crew were good. They'd been on for years, with Robbie the bosun, brilliant chap. And then there was a Crockford, so I used to call them the Crockford's Mafia from Tenby. And they were on for years, these seamen, you know. And so you got to know all the seamen, and they were really, really good. And obviously the officers, they were got used to the FID's way of doing things, and, you know, you'd help and help the galley peel potatoes and bits and pieces. Yeah, it was good.
Mm. I presume you called the Falklands on the way down, didn't you?
Again? Yeah, into Montevideo. Yeah, we went into Montevideo on the way.
Did you change ships there?
No. Yeah. No, went from Montevideo, which was always a run ashore, you know. First foreign place for most of us, you know, really foreign. And then we had the trip to the Falklands. And in fact, I got off in the Falklands, but the first trip for a month or so. Might have been a bit more than that. And did some work in the Falklands that they wanted doing because they knew I was there. And the rest of the crew went off down to Sydney. And then when the Pearl of Dan came in, which was the one going to Halibay with the building, then I got on the Pearl of Dan. And then we went to Sydney, picked up the Sydney, the rest of the building team, who had all transferred around. And then off we went down to Halibay.
And having finally got to the Antarctic, what did you make of Halibay?
I loved it. You know, I got off, and again with this Fanny Dave Hill, we got off, and it's just flat. You know, it's just flat. And I said, you know, I like it here. He said, what do you mean you like it? I said, I like it. And I did. And I never changed my mind. I never thought I didn't like it. You know, it was, yeah, I just, something about it. Yeah, it was great. Mm.
There was lots of work to do, wasn't there? Because we were in the middle of rebuilding Halley, if I remember correctly.
Yes, that's right.
So what met your eyes in terms of the building work that had to be done? What met your eyes when you arrived?
Well, you arrive, as you arrive, the old people, the base people that are waiting for the ship to come, they're all standing on the ice cliffs and that, so you're all there keen and that. And then, of course, you get ashore and it was really hectic building. I mean, we were working 12 hours a day, you know, really hard work. And it was all manual then. There were no real machines to help you. And it was the base got called Grillage Village because it was laid on we levelled out the snow and put corrugated iron down and big expanded metal and then laid all these beams out, the grillage, and then the big beams sat on top. And the panels were 8 feet apart, big steel portal frames, which we all had to lift up by hand, pull them up. And then once they were up, there were beams connecting them. And it was panelled with 3-inch-thick insulated panels and roofed over with a butyl roof. Mm-hmm. But it was hard work, you know. And we had no real facilities meal-wise. We had two cabooses, two little caravan-y things. And the cooks would do us soup and bits and pieces and the ship would send up some goodies and that. So, you know, lunchtime and smokos and that, they were all done out of these two cabooses and the cooks did a wonderful job, you know. And we didn't expect any more, you know, it was fine. You know, it was all there, you know, we got plenty to eat. But it was hard work, you know, you're 12 hours on of really hard work. And then you go back to the ship and probably have a few drinks and bed and back out again And there was a competition there were two shifts running. So there was a certain competition on how much you got done and could you get it finished before the next shift came on. But it was friendly, you know, it was good. It was really good. I think that's the thing with Bass. It's very camaraderie, you know, camaraderie. You know, and it was really good fun. And I think all the years I've been there, there's nobody that I haven't really liked, you know, No, nobody that's... And most people get on. There's been a few failures where people have got there and gone again and all that, but it's never affected me, I must say.
Did you find your carpentry skills have been given full scope?
Oh, yes.
You weren't having to bodge for the speed?
No, the building was built prefabricated, So we basically had to just put it together. But I think, you know, once the building was up, the main construction was up, the inside was to a great extent left to us to do what we want, not quite what we wanted. The bunk rooms were set. You know, we had the bunks were there and that. But there was a lot of work in the lounge that we could use their own skills, and people would make things and do things. I built a record cabinet, for example, you know, quite a big record cabinet with the because we all had records in those days. So I built a record, big record cabinet, a console. And one of the other chaps, there were some clever people, and he did all the wiring for it and the it was really just wiring it in and the speakers and that. But, you know, generally I suppose with my own carpentry, you know, the FIDs would come along and want to make things, and can you help me make this, can you help me make that? More the second year than the first year, because there was several of us carpenters and builders still. So more the second year, I guess, that people would... We did it the first year, but more the second year when I was on my own as a carpenter.
Did you get a sense of why the others were there, why all these chaps had gone to such a remote place? Was there a kind of a unifying factor?
I think the scientists... We used to always take the mickey out of them, because we used to sort of say, oh, here they come, you're another leaf on the cabbage of knowledge. And I think for them it must have been a really, really good step in their career, because the BAS would go around the universities looking for people. Mm. So for them to get a job down south must have been a really big deal, you know, and some of them obviously have done, they're worldwide scientists and that now. But so they were coming from university, and how much they knew about it, I don't know, but other Antarctic botanists or zoologists, they would have been working with those in England before they went, and they'd have a project to do. So they were, so that was their drive, I guess, to do a good job with that.
And did you kind of swap information with scientists? Did you learn about the science they were doing?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think that was one.
Was that a big thing?
Yes. Yeah, I found it really interesting that you were mixing with such a diverse group of people. That we'd get people to give lectures in the winter. You know, the doctor would give a talk and the geologist. And it was really interesting. But, I mean, you don't learn everything, but you certainly learnt a lot about what other people were doing. And it did help. Mm. The conference we used to have in Cambridge was slightly that, to tell you what other people were doing and that, so you could interact with them a bit. You know, why do you want the rock from the top of the mountain when there's a load of rubble at the bottom? We could just pick it up from there. You know, and they'd tell you why they needed it, so you understood why you've got to go up this damn mountain to get the rock if you were going to do that. But it was just interesting talking to other people on what they did, and I guess I've got an interest in just in general knowledge. I'm not that bright, but but you know, just to know what other people do is interesting. Yeah, and you know, we'd talk about things we did, you know, hobbies or. Give a talk on, because I'm a cyclist, you know, give a talk on cycling, and then people know why they've got to knock you off the road when they were back in England in their car. You know, it was just general knowledge among yourselves. And you were mixing with them all the time, too. You know, we didn't have the support staff and the scientific staff didn't keep separate. So you were mixing all the time and talking about what went on.
But did not the scientific staff actually stay in the old hut for quite a long time whilst you were... You began to start living in the new hut that you were building.
Yes.
They stayed in the old underground hut for a while, didn't they?
Well, that's right, yes. What happened was, as we were building the Greenwich Village, as we got on, the old base was falling to bits. We had the IGY hut, which International Degree of Physical Year, which was built 1950-something. Yeah. That was 60 feet down by then.
Mm.
And that was amazing going down there.
You went to it, did you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Tell me what that was like.
Well, when you first went to the old base, you went down a shaft, 6 foot square shaft, and they actually had a disaster with what we called the old living hut, which was meant to be two stories, but half the bolts got left behind, apparently, in the build. So it was a single story hut with a flat roof, and it fell to bits, and ceilings used to collapse in on you. So what they had to do, they built the office block, which was the nearest the surface. They went down the shaft into the office block tunnel, and then you went down again into the old bay, into the old living hut. And it was like going down into the gnomes, because it was because we used coal for heating, and still a lot of it. So all the corridors were dark and black, and there were stores in there. So you're going down like these little gnomes into the downstairs, and then into the old living hut. The IGY at this time was still used. Some of the scientists still had rooms down there and places. And but it was cold. It was cold down there, and the living hut was really falling to bits, and it was freezing. And when during the building, I don't jump about too much here. When we were building, we needed more materials. You know, we had the building for Village, but there was always extras. So Dave Hill and I used to go down the old base, and Ricky Chin, who was a base leader there, he said, right, from such and such a date, the IGY is shut. That's it. You've got to be out. And gradually people were moving up to Village. We did the bunk rooms. Once we got the dining room and that, the bunk rooms were then being done, so people could then move up, and we were working the offices. And so gradually there was a move away. And Ricky said, you know, the IGY is shut. So when we wanted stuff, we'd go down, and because they didn't want to leave because they'd been there a year. Oh, look, they haven't taken the stuff. We'd get all the stuff, put it in the middle of the floor, and then take the walls out. And the scientists would come, the bastards, they've stolen my office. Yeah, and we'd taken it all up.
For raw materials?
For the materials, yes, to use the materials. And then, you know, then in the end, that's shut. And the living hut, we used to go down there for films on Saturday night, and every 10 days we went down for a bath or shower. It was freezing. And you go down to the hut for your shower, and you're allowed 5 gallons of water in a 5 gallon oil tin with a garden hose rose on it. And you go down in the bathroom where the bath was cast iron. So you had to put a plastic bowl in the bath, put water in it, otherwise you've got frostbite on your feet. Truly. And then you get 5 gallons of water and you make it sort of warm enough, because it's now it's bloody cold down and freezing. Turn the water on, too hot. And even at minus 10, the water takes a long time to cold, so you tip it away. And water was a goodie, you know, you didn't want to waste. So you throw it away, more cold in than every shower. And I think we all did it and kept quiet. It didn't go and say, I've just wasted 5 gallons of water. But, you know, that was... And then the base gradually broke up. And the other one, when Dave and I used to go down there, we'd say to the cooks, oh, we're down, can we have dinner with you? Yeah, OK, fine. And because the base was breaking up, all the tables were on the slope and they were formica, and you never wiped them because it would freeze. You'd have and you'd put your plate on the table, it would hurtle off down the end. But you'd say, what time's dinner? 1 o'clock. And you'd be down there a few minutes, and there was nobody there. And where are they then? But they'd all come from the office block then, and they'd come down 1 o'clock, whoosh, eat their meal, 5 past, they'd gone.
Into the old hut and then back up again.
Back up.
Well, the kitchens were in the old hut still.
Yeah, they were still in the old hut, and the cooks would be there in their outdoor gear nearly. And I saw we had these big commercial trays, or the commercial cooking trays, and I saw a cook actually open a tin of peas, big tin of peas, and shoot it into one of these things, and it went and froze before you put it in the oven. And tea towels were frozen on the front, on the arga fronting it. It was really cold, you know. I think this must have been May time, I would think. It's certainly before midwinter, but it was, you know, the temperature was getting cold, and then gradually they shut the base, and then people moved up into the office block then. The office block then became the old base while we were still building. And then gradually as we got on, then they didn't actually close the base because they used it for dogs in the end, I think it might have gone for another year, I can't remember. But the office block became the base, and that was fine.
And that was also under the ice, was it?
Oh, yeah, that was under, yes. That was probably 20 feet, something like that. Yeah.
Did you ever have any awkward moments whilst you were salvaging materials from the IGY hut?
Sort of. Because the shaft from the IGY up was obviously long and it wasn't quite straight with the ice in it. And Dave Hill and I used to put, you know, we had to haul it all up this shaft, and one of us would be on the tractor pulling and the other one was down below. We couldn't see what was going on. So, you know, you'd tow it and you'd feel the rope go tight and you'd ease it off a bit if you were driving and wait till it loosened and off you'd go. But one day we had it full up with tins of paint. I was driving, and the bottom of the shaft had where the ice had gone down. It had made a curve. And so I'm towing this up, and something happened, and it tipped all this tins of paint up. And Dave Hill's down the bottom. There's all this paint hurtling down, and it hit this ramp, and he's legging it up along the corridor with these 2 gallon tins of paint going after me. Are you trying to kill me? I think that's the only time we had, and he's never forgiven me for that either.
He certainly hasn't.
Yeah, he never forgiven me for that.
He says there were 5 gallons.
Yeah, well, probably some were, you know, they were.
If one had connected with me, I wouldn't be writing this now.
No, that's right.
When you were building the Grillage Village base, was it intended that it would not sink below the ice? Or you built it knowing it would go down?
Yeah, knowing it was. They were built, when the IGY was built originally, it had windows. Because it was a traditional peninsula hut, if you like. But of course it got buried. So the building didn't have windows at all. There were no windows in it at all, so it was built to bury. And had big refrigerated thick doors, not wooden doors for the in and out, you know, the accommodative access doors. No, it was built to bury, built to be buried.
Did it work as a building?
Not entirely. The beams that in the roof that the roof sat on were notched out, and in fact the engineer that designed it was there, a really nice chap.
This is Colin.
Colin Baldwin. Yeah, and he really made a mistake actually, because he did his bending moments and all that, and he notched these 6x2s or 6x3s over each of the steel beams. Of course, it made a weak corner in timber, and they all split. So the roofs, once it started to get buried, started to break quite easily. And the chap that took over from me did a really good job on, because they'd hang down. And he got just blocks of wood and he drove them in on the between the flanges of the steel and the wood just to hold that piece up. That was a bit of a weakness in it. But the rest, I think, worked quite well for, I don't know how long they're designed for, 7 years, something like that. Mm. But it lasted quite well apart from that, you know, yes. Yes.
And what was it like to live in when you finally started using it properly?
Well, originally, when we started to build, we did the kitchen, dining room, and there was an office and an entrance hall initially. And we all lived up in the loft. And another chap, Tony Baker, who had been down before, he set it up in the loft, when we each had an 8-foot bay, and he got up there, because he'd been before, he knew the setup, and he got the paper from the mattresses, the Cardi paper, and he divided it up between each bay, so we had a paper wall between each of us, which actually made it quite private. So we had our lilos, and so we each had this 8-foot bay as our bunk room for a long time, and then we because some people went to bed earlier and some stayed up later, you know, I think 10 o'clock we had to put the record player off and try and be quiet. And then we just lived up in the loft, and their table was some of the doors we hadn't put on packing cases. And I mean, I guess it was fairly rough living, you know, because we didn't have any facilities there really. And that's why we used to go down to the old base every 10 days to have a shower and bit of a change, and I suppose we did some laundry. I think we probably did laundry as well, but that was during that time. It was quite rough living then, but it was fine. Yeah, it was warm in there, and we worked away, and it was.
Tell me about the Black Gang.
Oh, the Black Gang.
I'm getting a bit mixed up. There was a Black Hand Gang and a Black Gang.
It's the same thing.
Right. Well, who are the Black Hand Gang?
Well, the Black Gang was the mechanics. Basically, they were the mechanics,
and they had oily hands.
That's it.
Okay.
Yeah, they were the dirty men, not like us carpenters with clean wood.
Oh right, so you weren't part of the Black Hand Gang then?
Not, Not in itself, no. No, no. The only reason we were part of it was, I guess, what happened was there was no carpenter shop allowed in the garage. So with playing Dad Etchells with gin, he let us have two bays of the garage as a carpenter shop, because we really needed one, you know, to start with. So then, of course, because we were the practical people, the support people, you tend to have a stick together a little bit. And then, so we had the workshop there, and then for another bottle of gin, Dave Hill and I, with stealing stuff from the old base, we built an office for them. So, you know, we had this office at the end of the garage again, and it sort of became their office and a meeting place, and it just became known as down in with the Black Gang. So, right. And, you know, other people used to come in, and, you know, it wasn't only the mechanic-y builder type people, you know, anybody. It wasn't like that. It wasn't, you couldn't go anywhere else. But people did sort of tend to stick together, the office people, the Met Men and those people. They had an office, the whole block at the end, their office. So they sort of stuck together, and we sort of stuck together. But it wasn't...
wasn't cliquey.
No, it wasn't cliquey, no, at all. But that was a Black Gang, you know, so we sort of stuck together, and that was just known as a Black Gang.
Were they rebellious, or...?
No. No, of course not. Come on, please. No, not a bit of it. No. It was all very friendly. Very friendly indeed.
By the time you finished taking stuff from the previous base, what was left of it down below? Was it all recycled?
No, none of it. None of it was recycled at all. I think they...
You were taking stuff for raw materials, weren't you?
Yes. I mean, we just took what we needed to... Because one of the other jobs we did was the garage ramp. As it got buried, the base... To get the vehicles in and out of the garage with a ramp. And we used to build snow walls. And the bulldozer would bulldoze it out from the ground up to about roof level. So that was like 10 feet of accumulation to get the vehicles up.
Mm.
And then we used to hang tarpaulins down to try and stop it. And as it got deeper, we had to make the ramp longer. So then I used to build snowblock walls, but then we needed heavy timbers across the top to support a roof, and then we'd go and get the old material from the old base to form a roof over it to try and stop the snow coming in. And so gradually we'd build the roof up, and the ramp got longer, and so a lot of the material from the old base was used as roofing for the...
So you're building a sloping tunnel.
A sloping tunnel, yes. Yeah.
But if I went down now to where the previous base or the old base had been, would I find anything left of it at all?
No, well, it might well be out at sea. Mm. Because when I went down one of the other trips, one of the bases, you could see it coming out of the ice cliffs. So, because the ice is always moving out to sea. And so they probably will have gone to sea by now in an iceberg somewhere. All the stuff that was usable was saved. But the construction and the rest of the building wasn't. No, that was just... Well, you couldn't get it out anyway.
No.
You couldn't get it out anyway. I mean, you had a 6-foot square shaft that wasn't very straight to get it out of.
And did you see this kind of profile of the building sticking out of the ice cliff?
Yes.
You saw it yourself?
Yeah, it was the end of the building was hanging out. I just about remember that.
When was that roughly?
Must have been when I went down to do... That's been when we went down to Halley 5, I would have thought, I think.
In the 70s?
Yeah, 80s.
In the 80s?
80s, yes. Yeah, so I'm pretty 100, yeah, there was a base coming out of the... Because I think we had to move the ship, that's why I can't... Because the cliffs were all breaking up, and because Halley Bay broke up while we were there.
Mm.
And so they couldn't... That's where Halley Bay got its name, that's why it's now only Halley instead of Halley Bay. So they had to move around to what they call the third chip, which was further around the coast. So probably we went in and I saw the base coming out for just that
few
hours, or probably more hours than anything. till we had to move the ship round, and so probably never saw it again, but it was coming out of the ice.
Okay, tell me about Golly's Folly. Everybody mentions Golly's Folly, and I have no idea what they're talking about.
Well, I think that's quite a pride of mine, you know, because it was a roll-along caravan caboose.
Oh,
roll-along caravan caboose, which was just used, one of these things which I've mentioned earlier, was a kitchen. It was used as that. Well, when we did the big field trips, the experienced people before, with the tractors, you can keep going, you don't have to stop. And so rather than camp, you know, to drive for 12 hours or whatever, I mean, we used to drive all sorts of silly hours, rather than keep stopping and camping, it was decided to convert one of these roll-along caravans into a caravan to live in.
So with bunks?
With bunks. So I converted it into a six-berth caravan, and across the back were three bunks about 2 foot apart, something like that. And then one side, there were seats each side which formed a bunk, so that's five. And then one bunk was high up, that so you sat underneath, so that was the six of us in it that could sleep in it. So I built it with quite a lot of thought, and there was a kitchen in it, and it was quite a lot of thought and design went into doing it. Anyway, we used it really successfully, and it got the name Golly's Folly by there's this folly that he's doing. And it was used very successfully, and it's still being used. And
is it?
All these years, I think now it's in the Falklands. I think it came up to the Falklands 4 years ago. And a lot of people say, oh, I stayed in Golly's Folly. I know it's Golly's Folly. And I'm really quite proud that it's lasted so long and been quite a feature of the place. You know, it's quite a achievement, I think, really.
What was it like to look at? Did it resemble a gypsy caravan or just a box on wheels?
No, it's a box on a sledge.
On a sledge?
You know the square profile corrugated iron, that sort of shape? That's what it was. And with a flat roof and just a box, really. And we put it on a sledge. And, of course, there's no suspension in it. And when we were travelling, we used to drive 12-hour shifts when we went out on these big field trips. And if you're in bed, my bunk was right at the bottom. And if you were travelling, the thing used to climb up over the sastrugi and then drop the sledge. And it used to fling you up and it'd hit the bunk above you. And I'd think, well, that was a big one. And turn over and go back to sleep again, you know. Yeah, it really worked well. And, you know, we could just keep travelling. We used to stop and then for an hour on the trips and then change drivers and get something to eat. And one driver's doing breakfast and the other driver's having his evening meal. No, and I say it's really worked well. And I understand it's in the Falklands now. Yeah, so it's...
So it never came to grief? It never went down a crevasse?
No, not as far as I'm aware.
Or tipped over?
No. I got a feeling somebody said... They found it. I've got a feeling it might have been put away from out of base as a depot to use, and whether somebody left the door open or something. I think it got filled up with snow at some time, but that's I'm not sure about. But I've got a feeling it did. But it got used an awful lot as a field base. It was put out so people could use it while they were working away from base.
Where did you get your raw materials from for that? That wasn't part of the...
Probably part of the old base, and stuff that we had around as well. You know, there was a certain amount of material and that there anyway. We weren't completely devoid, but it all came from...
How far did the Follies got to go? Did it get as far as the Shackletons?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it went to the Shackletons. Yeah, the longest trip, that's another thing. There's, you know, that trip, the longest one we've ever done, unsupported, as Bass has done. And it went right to the Shackletons with us, yes.
Were you on that trip?
Yes, I was.
Tell me about that.
Well, I was lucky in that with my job, I didn't have a programme to do exactly, whereas the scientists had a programme they had to follow, so they couldn't not do it. And also, doing 2 years, because I was doing a second year, I could stay out over the... See over the relief season. So I went out with the tractors to start with, and we actually built a dog kennel as well. because Dad Etchells, who was well experienced in field travel, they used to tow the dogs before they used to run behind the tractors.
Yes.
Because that meant they had to stop. They had to stop every few hours. So I actually built a dog kennel with out of dunnage from the ship, the old stuff they used to put between the oil drums. So all the dogs were then in kennels, and so we could then just travel for as we used to travel till we decided to stop. You know, it could be 12 hours, 14 hours sometimes. You know, we just did it.
So the kennels were on sledges, were they?
The kennels were on sledges.
Or the dogs were having a ride,
yeah. And we put netting over the top. That didn't work. They'd sit there and look out and think this is a good deal. Anyway, we did a trip out, and there was a group of people out there already that had been taken out on the first trip, and geologists and surveyors. And they were taken out. Then the tractors came back and they picked me up, and we went out with dogs. And we were trying to get to the Shackleton Mountains, but nobody had really been there before. So we were doing a lot of surveying to get round the Slessor Glacier. Mm. But we had to go up the Beedmore Glacier, which nobody had been... I think I might have got that wrong. And it had never been done, and we had to double haul the tractors up there because sometimes you'd look out, you didn't know if you were moving. You'd actually look out of the tractor and see if you're actually moving. But in the end, we used to put two tractors on one sledge, and we got up the Beardmore Glacier, and we had to leave sledges behind. And then Dad Etchells and I were relaying, and we sort of went back and relayed and went back on again, and while the others were continuing on. So we did that. And while we were doing it, we were driving along, Dad Etchells and I. We used to sort of do, when should we stop? What time should we get up? What's the time now? Because it didn't matter, because it was daylight. Well, how many hours do you want in bed? 8? Now make it 10, you know, we've had a long day. And we're in bed one day, and we heard an aeroplane. What's this going on? And this aeroplane went over, which was very unusual. Well, it was only later we found it's when... John Brotherhood and another chap fell over the ice cliffs at Halley Bay. So the plane was going to pick him up, but apparently at the same time Deception Island blew up. So they're all onto Ted Clapp in Stanley at the office. And they said, oh, emergency, and Ted Clapp saying, get off the line, you know, Deception's... No, the doctor, I think it was the doctor... You know, the doctor's on, you know, we've got an emergency at Halley. Yeah, but Deception's blowing up. We've got an emergency here. I think they were both going at the same time.
Yeah.
But we heard the plane, which was, you know, very unusual for us. An aeroplane, you know, which was the one going to Halley to pick up Doc Brotherhood. And then we... So what happened? We drove the tractors down to a main depot where the tractors then had to turn back. And then four of us, Mike Skidmore, Pete Noble, Nick Mathis and myself, stayed out with the dogs. And then we tried going around the glacier, and we would just had to go around the edge of it till we got so far. Then we were managing to get round it. And because my poor Mike Skidmore, the glacier geologist, I hadn't seen a rock. So we tried to get him to the mountains, and him and... Pete Noble, they went south and we relayed for them till we had to turn back. And then we turned back and then we had to wait because we wanted to wait to be as near to them as possible in case anything happened. Mm. So we had like 10 days or something like that just to wait. So you're in the middle of nowhere now. What do you do? I think I'll build a cairn so they can find their way back. And I built this enormous cairn like it was 10 foot square at the bottom and 12 feet high, and it stood out like a sore thumb there. And when they were coming back, they said they could see this darn thing, you know, and what the devil's that, you know, because what we did when they were coming back, Nick and I then headed, we'd done two sides of a triangle by this time, so we then headed back to the top of the bit of the crossing zone, what they called 01. So we just took a bearing for that, and we did 50 miles across the country. Nobody done it before. And then when Pete and that were there, we turned around and went, well, we ran out of supplies. That's as far as we could go anyway. So we turned and came back and we all met up, and then we sledged back to base, getting back later. But the following year when we went out, Norris Riley, the surveyor who was doing our navigating, when we were 01, he said, right, go that way. So away we went, and then every now and again he'd do a sunshot, and he said, just tweak the left-hand lever a bit, because the tractors used to veer. He said, just tweak the lever and keep the eye. And anyway, we stopped after 200 miles, and in the morning we got up, and somebody said, I can see a cairn over there. And in 200 miles down and 50 miles up, we'd missed by half a mile or something like that. Fantastic. You know, and we were doing it just with a prismatic compass and air course up. And then we went back to this base and continued on from there. You know? Mm-hmm.
Were you involved at all in the Brotherhood episode?
No, I wasn't.
Because you were away from base?
I was away from base at the time, yeah. No, I had nothing to do with that, no. And it was only really when we got back, because radio communication with us in the field was quite difficult at that time. You know, it was, we all had to learn Morse code to a certain extent. So, you know, I'm not sure. I think I'm not quite sure if we knew something had happened or not till we got back to base. I'm not quite sure whether. But I certainly had nothing to do with it. I wasn't there at all.
Okay, and there was another tragedy we mentioned earlier.
Oh, Neville Mann.
Yeah. So, again, were you around for that?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't there again, but I lived in the Falklands. During my time in the Falklands, as I said earlier, I got to know a lot of the people that were coming through, and Neville Mann was... I got to know him quite well, because he must have been up and down a few times. Mm. And he got quite friendly with one of the girls in the Falklands. And, of course, then we heard that him and his dog team were lost. So... When I went south, they'd actually built a memorial to the people on a sledge. They brought rocks from somewhere and built a memorial on a sledge which they used to move around so it didn't get lost. And this girl said, would I take a wreath down for him? Which I did. So I took this wreath down and put on the monument. And so that was, you know, it was really touching to do that. But it's nice to know that the people are still remembered. And I think the monument is still there too, yes. Which was almost brings me on to one of my most frightening times down there. During the first summer, we were building, but to give us a bit of a break, some of the dog people and that were going out onto the sea ice and shooting seal and then bringing them back with the dogs. And to give us a run out, you know, day off from work, they'd take us out sometimes. And we went out with a chap that, I'm not saying any names, but he should have known what he was doing. And as you go off Halley Bay, the cliffs, the snow blows off the top. Mm. And if it starts to blow off, you have about 20 knots. And you think, no, it's not time to go on the sea ice. Anyway, we went on the sea ice. He said, oh, so I'll set a compass. And I think we're about 5 miles out. Anyway, set the compass and away we went. We loaded the seal and that. When we came back, we couldn't see the darn cliffs. And we couldn't see the tracks either. And I was terrified, because knowing Neville Mann had got lost. And you've got a very small gap to hit, because the cliffs are 80 feet high. So you've only got this small
slope
to get up. And I was terrified there for a while. But luckily, we picked the dog tracks up, because the people had been in and out, in and out. Luckily, we picked the dog tracks up, and then we were fine and we were away. And that was a big learning lesson. Do not go on the sea ice when the drift's going over the edge. You know, I think that was probably my most frightening time in a way.
So in those days, there was no kind of, it wasn't forbidden to do that kind of thing. There was no written down rules about where you can and can't go, which there would be today.
I guess so. Yeah, no. Well, they needed the seals for the dogs.
So
somebody went out and shot the seal and brought them back and to feed the dogs, yes. Yes, that was frightening.
Not surprised. you did a third summer at Halley, is that right?
Yes.
And then found yourself at South Georgia. And we'll perhaps talk about that in a moment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right.